In order to get a solid understanding of what our immigration policy should look like and how it should operate, we have to begin from the consent principle. And the consent principle is the corollary of the idea that all men are created equal. Consent is required on both sides. So consent has to be mutual and reciprocal. All parties to the contract must agree both to be part of that society, but also to the membership of all the other parties. It can't simply be one side imposing itself on the other. That's not a relationship of equals. Hello and welcome to Session 4 of Hillsdale College's online course on public policy. My name is Kevin Porteous, and today we're going to be talking about immigration as an issue in American public policy. Now, I'd like to do things just a little bit differently. Immigration is one of the enduring issues of our politics. It seems to be a constant issue for us. It seems to be a matter of constant concern. There's always a new crisis. There's always a new there's always a new consideration in immigration policy. But at the same time, there's also very little clear thinking about the relationship between first principles, the Constitution, and public policy positions and outcomes. And there's also very little consideration, conscious consideration, of the effect of immigration, particularly mass immigration, on the character of the American regime. So, what I want to do today is, instead of getting bogged down in so-and-so's proposal or the current crisis or some particular outrage or incident regarding immigration into the United States, I want to provide a general framework that will help you get a foundation for thinking about immigration policy more generally. So what we're going to do is we're going to begin with the central principle of the American regime as expressed in places like the Declaration of Independence and elsewhere, and that is the equality principle, the idea that all human beings by nature are equal in their natural rights and their natural obligations. Now, the immediate corollary of the equality principle for political society is the consent principle. If all men are created equal, then government must be based upon the consent of the governed. No one person has an inherent right to govern another person. And it's only because of the equality principle that we have to be concerned about consent. Now, there's a lot of belief, misunderstanding that somehow the claims that people have to rights or to equality somehow trumps other considerations and mandates in some way that we allow unlimited immigration into the United States and that we have no right to exercise any kind of jurisdiction over it. And I want to try and address some of those concerns today in the course of this talk. So we're going to look at three basic problems in immigration, and then at the end, we'll try and do some connecting to contemporary issues. Now, the first of these is the concept of birthright citizenship. Now, birthright citizenship enjoys a lot of currency today. It's commonly accepted. One recent paper prepared for congressmen by the Congressional Research Service stated that, quote, the states and courts in the United States in early America apparently adopted the birthright citizenship doctrine, which is referred to as jus soli, or right of soil. So if you are born in a particular place, then you are a citizen of that place. Now, if you go back and look to the origins of that doctrine in the English common law, you will find that this idea of birthright citizenship is a relic of English or European feudalism. And it didn't have quite the welcoming connotation that it has today. Sir Edward Coke, the English jurist, in the 17th century, in the very famous Calvin's case, described what birthright citizenship meant. He said, allegiance is a true and faithful obedience of the subject due to his sovereign. This allegiance or obedience is an incident inseparable to every subject, for as soon as he is born, he oweth by birthright allegiance and obedience to his sovereign. Now, this is a reciprocal bond, wherein the subject is obligated to service and obedience while the sovereign is obligated to protect the subject. One's status is defined by one's birth. So, returning to Coke, who says, they that are born under the obedience, power, faith, legiality, or legions of the king are natural citizens and no aliens. So what that meant was you were tied to the land of your birth, wherever you happened to be born. You were tied to that place, and you were an inseparable citizen of that regime. Now, the monarch or the sovereign owed you protection, but you owed him lifelong obedience, and that was something that you could not sever. The sovereign could release you from that bond, but you could not expatriate yourself. And the reason for that was fairly straightforward. The understanding was, this is a debt that you owe to the sovereign of that nation, that you must pay back over the course of your life for the protection that he gave you from birth when you could not protect yourself. Okay, so birthright citizenship then is, like I said, it's a throwback to feudalism. Now, what's interesting is that the American Founding Fathers explicitly rejected this concept. James Wilson, in the early Supreme Court case Chisholm v. Georgia, said, quote, "Under the Constitution, there are citizens, but no subjects." So citizenship in a free self-governing regime based on founding principles is something different from subjection. The Massachusetts Constitution, which was written in 1780, does a very good job of summing this up. It says, "The body politic is formed by a voluntary association of individuals. It is a social compact," unquote. That is to say, political obligation is not the result of birth. It is the result of, or the consequence of, the voluntary consent of free individuals. So it's not something where you're tied to a particular place because of the accident of your birth, but you must, as a rational actor, as a human being with inherent rights, consent or agree to be governed by a particular regime. Okay. Now, the place where you are likely to find the constitutional debate over this issue center is in the 14th Amendment. And it is commonly understood today that the first section of the 14th Amendment confers birthright citizenship on all persons born in United States sovereign territory. But that also is extremely problematic and doesn't represent an accurate reading of that text. Now, Section 1 of the 14th Amendment says that all persons born or naturalized in the United States and subject to the jurisdiction thereof shall be citizens of the United States and the state in which they reside. Okay? But if you're paying attention there, there are two requirements of citizenship. There are two things that have to happen in order for you to be considered a citizen. You have to be born or naturalized in the United States. That's one. So a natural-born citizen is someone who's going to be born in the United States. Now, there are certain specified exemptions and exceptions in the law to this, but generally speaking, born in the United States. But there's also a second provision, subject to the jurisdiction thereof. Okay. Now, one of the basic rules of constitutional interpretation is that every provision in the Constitution means something. It's not just fluff, and it's not redundant. So one can't say, well, you're born in the United States, and since you're here, you're subject to the jurisdiction of the United States. Well, that is true. If you are a non-citizen, you are subject to the jurisdiction of the United States for as long as you are in the United States. But once you leave, that bond is broken for non-citizens. In the case of citizens, that bond doesn't cease. So if you were to go on vacation, you take a trip to Europe or Japan or something like that, you don't cease to be a United States citizen. However, a non-citizen in the United States, when he leaves the United States, any legal relationship or political relationship between that alien and the United States ceases. Okay? So it's not simply enough to be born in the United States. Subject to the jurisdiction thereof means something different. It's a separate additional requirement, okay, beyond simply being born here. And what they meant by that was that you were not lawfully subject to the law or the rule of any other nation or sovereign or ruler. So that if you were, if your parents were tourists from, say, the Republic of Korea, and your mother gave birth to you in the United States. Now, as long as you're here, you're under our laws. But your citizenship doesn't follow the place of your birth so much as it follows your parentage, at least for children. So children follow the status of their parents. The parents, your parents in this case, are lawfully subject to the jurisdiction of the Republic of Korea, and therefore the 14th Amendment's understanding is you are a citizen of the Republic of Korea and not of the United States. Okay? If you look at the intention of the 14th Amendment and of that passage in particular, the intention was clearly, going back, looking at the text and at the legislative history and the debates over the 14th Amendment, the intent was clearly to confer citizenship upon freed slaves, persons who were born in the United States almost without exception and had no other obligation of citizenship. They were not subject to the jurisdiction of any other sovereign or ruler. Now, if you think about the condition of slavery, it is a kind of feudalism. It's an extreme case of feudalism, but the principle is somewhat similar. That is to say, slaves were born into a particular condition, servitude, and they were bound to their masters, just like a feudal subject was bound to his lord or to his king. And that was a bond that the slave could not break. In other words, a slave could only be released from his obligation as a slave by his master's assent. Okay? This is something that they wanted to, reject in the 14th Amendment, to get rid of this in conferring citizenship upon freed slaves. The framers rejected this aspect of slavery, this kind of feudal obligation, so that one representative in Congress expressed the general sense of Congress when he concluded that, quote, "It is high time that feudalism were driven from our shores and eliminated from our law, and now is the time to declare it." Now, this was stated by one of the representatives in Congress, and again, it expressed the general sense of Congress during the debates in the 1860s on the 14th Amendment. They were explicitly attempting to get rid of this notion of birthright obligation. And this was not a radical thing to get rid of birthright obligation. What the authors of the 14th Amendment were attempting to do was to extend to freed slaves the natural law conception of citizenship based on free consent, free association. One example of the way in which citizens differed from subjects was that citizens possess a right of expatriation, that is to say, the right to leave. Slaves didn't have the right to leave, and feudal subjects of a feudal lord did not possess the right to leave. Congress, at about the same time they passed the 14th Amendment, passed a bill called the Expatriation Act in 1868, which declared expatriation, the right to leave, to be, quote, "a natural and inherent right of all people." This view, taken in the 1860s, explicitly follows Jefferson's understanding of the natural right of individuals to leave one jurisdiction, settle somewhere else, and either establish a new regime or become a citizen there. So in the summary view of the rights of British America, which Jefferson wrote in 1774, he says, quote, "Our ancestors, before their emigration to America, were the free inhabitants of the British dominions in Europe and possessed a right, which nature has given to all men, of departing from the country in which chance, not choice, had placed them, of going in quest of new habitations, and of there establishing new societies, under such laws and regulations as to them shall seem most likely to promote public happiness." The 14th Amendment was not radical. What was radical was the founders' rejection of feudal obligation, of birthright citizenship. They were explicit about it. And there are many more examples of statesmen and thinkers from the founding rejecting feudal obligation and birthright citizenship. So the question is, how did we get it back? If it's not in the founders' thought and it's not in the Constitution, what happened? Well, what happened was the Supreme Court. And the United States Supreme Court, towards the end of the 19th century, in a case called United States v. Wong Kim Ark, involving the case of a person of Chinese extraction who was born in the United States but left the United States and then was denied the right of reentry to the United States under the Chinese Exclusion Acts, and then sued claiming, "I'm an American citizen." And the court in this case sided with Wong Kim Ark and said, yes, he is a citizen. The justice writing the opinion, Horace Gray, says, quote, "Birthright citizenship, which had been in force by the law of England for the last three centuries, beginning before the settlement of this country, was in force in all the English colonies upon this continent, down to the time of the Declaration of Independence, and in the United States thereafter." In other words, what the majority in the court did in the Wong Kim Ark case was to ignore all of the documentary evidence that established the contrary, and simply to assert, oh yes, birthright citizenship was obviously what the founders meant. All they were doing was carrying forward the English common law. Now, we know that to be patently false. As I said, the documentary evidence, the legal evidence is massive in the other direction. The court in this case simply chose to ignore it, and since then, we have accepted the court's decision. Uncritically, or mostly uncritically. And so now we have the principle of birthright citizenship. Now, interestingly enough, 15 years earlier, Horace Gray, the very same justice who wrote this opinion, authored an opinion in another case where he denied the idea of feudal obligation and affirmed the founders' conception of citizenship based on consent. Okay, so that's one issue, the problem of birthright citizenship. The second issue that I'd like to look at is the issue of immigration rights and the concept of national sovereignty. The consent theory requires that each person's membership in a society be a matter of mutual consent. Go back to the 1780 Massachusetts Constitution, where it says, quote, "The body politic is formed by a voluntary association of individuals. It is a social compact by which the whole people covenants with each citizen, and each citizen covenants with the whole people, that all shall be governed by certain laws for the common good." So each person has to agree to be part of the society, but the consent also has to work in the other direction. That is to say, the rest of the people in that society have to consent to take on the other person as a member of that society. If you don't have that mutual consent, it's not a relationship of equals. If you don't have that mutual consent, then it opens up the possibility that one party to the contract can simply impose his will on the other parties to the compact. So the phenomenon that we have today is persons coming to the United States in contravention of our laws and living here in contravention to our laws, and then telling the rest of the country, your law says that I have to do X, Y, and Z in order to be in this country. I don't care what your law says, and there's nothing you can do about it. At that point, you don't have a relationship among equals. You have a relationship of superior and subordinate. If that doesn't sound absurd to you, put it in reverse. Ask yourself, can we kidnap people from foreign countries, bring them to the United States, and rightfully force them to be there? We tried that once, or we did that once, called slavery. And it's a massive problem in regards not only of the Constitution as it's currently written, but also of our first principles. And that's something else the founders understood. You can't do that. It's not a relationship of equals at that point. And it's therefore not a basis for free self-government or voluntary citizenship. This is enshrined in the Constitution, in the power in Article 1, Section 8, where Congress can establish a uniform rule of naturalization. And so what this means essentially is that the federal government, acting as the agent of the people of the United States, can declare the terms which upon which an outsider can come into our society, can live here, and can become an American citizen. If the outsider, if the alien, voluntarily agrees to those terms and lives according to them, then we will extend citizenship to that person according to the procedures and laws of our society. So James Wilson, very prominent among the founding fathers in his own time, says that the social contract is an assemblage equal in number to the number of individuals who form the society, and that to each of these agreements, a single individual is one party, and all the other individuals of the society are the other party. Again, just as the individual must consent to live within the community must consent to the membership of each individual. Remember, there is no natural right to citizenship within a particular community. That's a right accorded by the society itself. Remember what natural rights are: rights that exist when there are no civil societies. So there can't be a natural right to live in a particular civil society because those rights are not granted or do not exist with regard to a particular society. So membership in a society is a matter of compact or contract among people and not a matter of inherent rights. A society has the right to regulate who is allowed to enter its territory. A nation, to the rest of the world, is a single entity. So when the citizens or governments of foreign nations look at the United States, they don't see my house and your house and your neighbor's house. They see the sovereign territory of the United States. And as far as the rest of the world is concerned, that's simply the United States. And the people of the United States, acting through their government, can regulate ingress into the United States just as you on your own property, your own home or your farm or your business, have a right under the natural law to regulate ingress onto that property. In other words, outsiders, people whom you don't want in your house, can't simply open the door, plop themselves down and say, you know what, this is really nice. I think I'll hang out here for a while. It's the same principle, okay? So that returning to James Wilson, he says, a state may be described a complete body of free persons united together for their common benefit to enjoy peaceably what is their own and to do justice to others. It is an artificial person. It has an understanding and a will peculiar to itself. It deliberates and resolves. It has rules, it has obligations, and it has rights. So again, like a society, like an individual, excuse me, a society has power over its property, restricting access to outsiders. And this, too, is enshrined in the Constitution. The power in Article 1, Section 8, to define and punish offenses against the law of nations. Now, this concept of the law of nations is simply the law of nature, natural law, applied to nations. And this, again, you find in someone like James Wilson. Jefferson confirms that the foremost component of the law of nations is, quote, the moral law of our nature, unquote. And this is because, returning to Jefferson, the moral duties which exist between each individual in a state of nature accompany them into a state of society. And the aggregate of the duties of all the individuals composing the society composes the duties of that society toward any other, so that between society and society the same moral duties exist as did between the individuals composing them while in an unassociated state, their maker not having released them from those duties on their forming themselves into a nation. Mm-hmm. Now, what all this adds up to is that non-citizens have no right to be here and cannot impose themselves on us. The immigrant has no right to establish himself as the lawful superior of any person now existing in the United States. You have to have a relationship of equals. And if one party can dictate to the other without the other's consent, then that's not a relationship of equals. So what happens when a person becomes a citizen is that the person who wishes to become a citizen declares his intention in some fashion or another, and the people of the United States, acting through their government, say, okay, here are our terms. And the outsider can say, I accept those terms and wish to become a citizen, or I reject those terms. If those terms are rejected, then the United States and the potential citizen, who's now no longer a potential citizen, go their separate ways. The obligations to respect the rights of each remain, but there's no compact formed between the people of the United States and that prospective citizen. So the tie is terminated. Okay. So that much by way of the idea of national sovereignty. The final issue that we need to discuss today is the character of citizens. This is a problem that is somewhat unique to a self-governing regime like the United States. Republican government, small r Republican government, requires a particular kind of citizen. Madison notes in one of his essays that, quote, public opinion sets bounds to every government and is the real sovereign in every free one. If that's the case, if public opinion is sovereign, and I think that is correct under the Constitution, then the opinions that people have and the values that they hold have to be ones that, broadly speaking, support free self-government. The 1776 Virginia Declaration of Rights, which was used in the drafting of the Declaration of Independence, and is a great representative sample of much of the founders' thinking, proclaims that, quote, no free government or the blessings of liberty can be preserved to any people, but by a firm adherence to justice, moderation, temperance, frugality, and virtue, and by frequent recurrence to fundamental principles. That is to say, there are certain characteristics of Republican citizens that we need in order for the regime to endure. Madison also points out in Federalist 55 that, yes, there's good and bad, virtuousness and viciousness in human nature. And we have to take into account both, but we also have to recognize that Republican government, self-government, requires more of the good than any other form of government. So he says, quote, as there is a degree of depravity in mankind, which requires a certain degree of circumspection and distrust, so there are other principles in human nature which justify a certain portion of esteem and confidence. Republican government presupposes the existence of these qualities in a higher degree than any other form. And that makes a lot of sense. If you are the subject of a tyrant, an absolute monarch or a tin hat dictator, then what you really need to know about your political life is shut up, do what you're told, behave, conform. You don't learn about living responsibly when no one is forcing you to. You don't learn about standing up for your rights. You don't learn about respecting the rights of others because nobody has any rights that are recognized by that society. Citizens must possess, at a bare minimum, respect for the rights of others, moderation, and, perhaps more controversially, manliness, respect for their own rights. They have to be willing to accept that other human beings in the society have the same rights as they do. But they also have to recognize that if they are to retain those rights, they must be willing to defend them, even at the risk of their own life or property. This is the manly firmness that the Declaration of Independence refers to. And again, at a bare minimum, both of those attributes are necessary. So immigrants, however, because of their regime of origin, in many cases, are unlikely to possess these characteristics. And Jefferson states on his notes of the state of Virginia that we have peculiar principles, which he describes as, quote, a combination of the freest principles of the English Constitution with others derived from natural right and from natural reason. To these, nothing can be more opposed than the maxims of absolute monarchies. That is to say, people are going to come here because it is a refuge for the oppressed. And that's great. We want people to come here in order to escape oppression. But we also have to recognize that these people have developed habits of mind and habits of behavior that were greatly influenced by the tyrannical regimes from which they originated. And it's going to be very difficult to adapt them or for them to assimilate to our way of life. So Jefferson continues in Notes on the State of Virginia, quote, they will bring with them the principles of the governments they leave, imbibed in their early youth, or, if able to throw them off, it will be in exchange for an unbounded licentiousness, passing, as is usual, from one extreme to another. It would be a miracle were they to stop precisely at the point of temperate liberty. So the danger then is that persons who come from tyrannies will either A, remain servile, that is to say, not be willing to assert their rights, to lack that vigilance, to lack that manly firmness that's necessary on the part of citizens, or they'll go right over to the other extreme, that is to say, they'll go crazy. They'll pass from servility to licentiousness. Now, Gouverneur Morris, another prominent member of the Constitutional Convention, happened to be in France when the French Revolution broke out. And he described the situation as one of utter chaos. Every crime and abomination that one could think of was taking place in Paris in 1789. And the reason for that is very straightforward. The people of France had no experience with personal self-government. So that when they were released from the yoke of the Bourbon monarchy, they had no idea what it meant to order their own lives in a rational and intelligible way. They simply did whatever they wanted. They thought that freedom meant the absence of restraint. And what they didn't realize was that there's a difference between liberty as part of the founder's natural law principles and license, the unrestrained ability to do as one pleases without regard for the rights of other people. They didn't understand that. And so we're going to have the same problem in different ways. It will manifest itself based on the people we're getting in different ways. So these new citizens or would-be new citizens have to adopt our values. Part of the reason they came here, in most cases, is because the place they came from was not a good place for them to live, mostly because it was tyrannical and impoverished and so on. Think about your own ancestors and why they came here, and you'll often find the same situation. My own ancestors did not come here from Russian Poland and the German Empire and Italy because those were great places for peasants to live in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. Too many immigrants at a time has the risk of changing the character of the regime. Benjamin Franklin noted in the 1750s that Pennsylvania, quote, will in a few years become a German colony. Instead of their learning our language, we will learn theirs or live as in a foreign country. It's also a problem when too many immigrants from the same place settle in one particular locale because it encourages them to retain their old values, their old customs, their old traditions. George Washington recognized this and said, "The advantage of immigration and settlement taking place in a body, I mean the settling of them in a body, may be much questioned. For, by so doing, they retain the language, habits, and principles, good or bad, which they bring with them." And we can see, when we put these three points together, the discussion of birthright citizenship, the discussion of national sovereignty, the discussion of the character of citizens, that in the 20th century, and as we've moved closer to our own time, perhaps more dramatically, we see examples or manifestations of the problem or problems that occur when we don't have a clear understanding of our own principles in relation to immigration. So, for instance, Franklin Roosevelt's coalition, the New Deal coalition, was dependent upon immigrant votes from Southern and Eastern Europe. The evidence that we have suggests very strongly that these immigrants tended to vote overwhelmingly Democratic, while native-born Americans continued to vote Republican. And so FDR's transformation of the country in the 1930s relied very heavily on first-generation Americans and their children who were not fully assimilated into our way of life. There's also the problem of crime. That's another issue, including organized criminal activity. So, for instance, some of my ancestors came from Italy. And one of the things that some Italian immigrants brought with them was the method of political organization that existed in the old country, which had a lot to do with tribalism, with family ties, and of course it achieved its most sinister manifestation in the mafia. It took generations for those immigrants to adapt to our way of life. Today we have a whole host of new different pockets of immigrants with their own organized criminal activity. So Colombians, Mexicans, Hong Kong Chinese, Koreans, Russians, Salvadorans. One report from the U.S. government suggested that 75% of the Nigerians at that point living in the United States, that is to say the mid-1990s, were involved in financial scams. A more recent example, a more direct example, would be the settling of tens of thousands of Somalis in Minneapolis, Minnesota, and the crime that has come with that. We have social disease that accompanies mass immigration. So in 2000, 31% of Mexican households were on welfare of some kind, compared to 15% of native-born households. In 2004, 46% of births to Hispanic women were out of wedlock, compared to 24.5% of non-Hispanic whites. Outside of our borders, even in recent weeks and months, we can see examples of the problem. The Germans, who have admitted perhaps hundreds of thousands of Middle Eastern refugees into their country with very little regard for what they were admitting, have now seen a massive increase in the number of rapes perpetrated by refugees. The city of Freiburg, Germany, recently decided, or at least businesses, clubs, nightclubs, bars within the city of Freiburg have decided that they will not admit refugees. Why? Because as soon as the refugees begin to show up, pickpocketing and sexual assault cases skyrocket. There's a connection. In Rotherham, in the United Kingdom, they're just getting clear of, or perhaps still in the middle of, a massive scandal involving 1,400 or more cases of child rape perpetrated overwhelmingly by Pakistani men living inside the country. Entire cities or parts of cities in Europe are unsafe. Malmo, Sweden, Brussels in Belgium, Luton in the United Kingdom, all have large Muslim majorities where it's simply not safe for non-Muslims, particularly non-Muslim women, to venture. So what do we draw from all of this? Conclusions. The equality principle requires that government must be based on the consent of the governed. Consent to manifest real equality must be mutual and reciprocal among all the members of that political community. Citizenship in a regime based on founding principles is not a matter of place of birth, but of this mutual consent. Those persons comprising a political community have the right to regulate ingress into their territory. Outsiders have no right to impose themselves on a community without the latter's consent. Republican government requires citizens of a particular character, which immigrants are often unlikely to possess. This is not an argument for no immigration. It's an argument for rational plans regarding immigration. Allowing too many at one time, or too many of the wrong kind at one time, into the country is productive of numerous political and social ills. In other words, America has a right and a duty to regulate immigration in the national interest, in the interest of American citizens. That's why our government exists, to secure the rights of American citizens and not necessarily the rights of anyone else. Thank you for your time today.